but not quite as easy to realize that you form your physical body as effortlessly and unself-consciously as you translate feelings into symbols that become words.
Long pause at 11:01.
You have heard the expression before, I am sure, that the environment expresses a particular individual's personality. I am telling you that this is a literal and not symbolic truth. The letters upon the page have the reality only of ink and paper. The information they convey is invisible. As an object, this book itself is only paper and ink. It is a carrier of information. You may perhaps argue that the book was manufactured physically and did not suddenly erupt through Rupert's skull, already printed and bound. You, in turn, had to borrow or purchase the book, so you may think, surely I did not create the book as I created my words. But before we are finished, we will see that, basically speaking, each of you create the book you hold in your hands, and that your entire physical environment comes as naturally out of your inner mind as words come out of your mouths, and that man forms physical objects as unself-consciously and as automatically as he forms his own breath. End of dictation for this evening.
Smile. Good night, Seth, and thank you. 11:14 p.m. Session 524, April 20th, 1970, 9:18 p.m., Monday. Jane didn't feel particularly well this evening, but decided to sit for a session to see what developed. When she began speaking, her pace was quite slow, and her eyes were closed most of the time.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now for our book. The peculiar, particular aspects of your physical world are dependent upon your existence and focus within it. The physical universe does not contain physical objects of solidity, width and depth, for example, to those whose existence is not within it. Other kinds of consciousness coexist within the same space that your world inhabits. They do not perceive your physical objects, for their reality is composed of a different camouflage structure. You do not perceive them, and generally speaking, they do not perceive you. This is a general statement, however, for various points of your realities can and do coincide, so to speak. These points are not recognized as such, but they are points of what you could call double reality, containing great energy potential, coordinate points indeed, where realities merge. There are main coordinate points, pure mathematically, sources of fantastic energy, and subordinate coordinate points, vast in number.
Long pause at 9:29.
There are four absolute coordinate points that intersect all realities. These coordinate points also act as channels through which energy flows and as warps or invisible paths from one reality to another. They also act as transformers and provide much of the generating energy that makes creation continuous in your terms.
Many pauses.
Your space is filled with these subordinate points, and as you will see later, these are important in allowing you to transform thoughts and emotions into physical matter. When a thought or emotion attains a certain intensity, it automatically attracts the power of one of these subordinate points and is therefore highly charged and in one way magnified, though not in size. These points impinge upon what you call time as well as space. There are certain points in time and space, therefore, again in your terms, that are more conducive than others, where both ideas and matter will be more highly charged. Practically speaking, this means that buildings will last longer in your context, that ideas wedded to form will be relatively eternal. The pyramids, for example, are a case in point.
Slow at 9:43.
These coordinate points, absolute, main, or subordinate, represent accumulations or traces of pure energy, minute to an extreme if you are thinking in terms of size, smaller than any particle of which your scientists know, for example, but composed of pure energy. And yet this energy must be activated. It is dormant until then, and it cannot be activated physically.
950.
Now, a few clues here that might help you, or mathematicians. There is an ever so minute alteration of gravity forces in the neighborhood of all of these points, even of the subordinate ones, and all the so-called physical laws, to some extent or another, will be found to have a wavering effect in these neighborhoods. The subordinate points also serve in a way as supports, as structural intensifications within the unseen fabric of energy that forms all realities and manifestations. While there are traces or accumulations of pure energy, there is a great difference between the amount of energy available in the various subordinate points and between the main and the absolute points. You may take your break.
9:57. Jane felt better now. She was surprised when I told her the delivery had been so slow. In trance, she is unaware of her pauses or of their number. "I haven't any sense of time, then," she said. "My space is filled. I don't know how else to put it." Resume in the same manner at 10:17.
These are points, therefore, of concentrated energy. The subordinate points are far more common and, practically speaking, affect your daily concerns. There are better places than others to build houses or structures, points where health and vitality are strengthened, where, other things being equal, plants will grow and flourish, and where all beneficial conditions seem to meet. Some people can sense such neighborhoods instinctively. They occur within certain angles made by coordinate points. The points obviously are not themselves physical. That is, they are not visible, though they may be mathematically deduced. They are felt, however, as intensified energy.
10:23.
In a given room, plants will grow more effectively in a particular area than in other areas, providing that both areas contain such necessary requirements as light. All of your space is permeated by these coordination points so that certain invisible angles are formed.
10:26.
This is highly simplified, but some angles will be more on the outskirts than others and will be less favorable for all conditions of growth and activity. In speaking of these angles, we will treat them as three-dimensional, though they are, of course, multidimensional. Since the nature of these angles is not the main topic of my book, it is not possible to explain them thoroughly here. They will seem to be stronger during certain times than other times, though these differences have nothing to do with either the nature of the coordinate points or of the nature of time. Other elements affect them, but we need not be concerned with these now.
10:31.
The concentrated energy points are activated by emotional intensities that are well within your normal range. Your own emotions or feelings will activate these coordinates, whether you know of them or not. Greater energy will therefore be added to the original thought or feeling, and its projection into physical matter accelerated. Now this applies regardless of the nature of the feeling, only its intensity is involved here. These points are like invisible power plants, in other words, activated when an emotional feeling or thought of sufficient intensity comes into contact. The points themselves intensify whatever activates them in a quite neutral manner. We are rather slow with this material since it is new, but mainly because I would like it translated into as precise terms as possible. And without a scientific background on Rupert's part, I must use ingenuity. You may take a break.
10:39 to 11:14.
Now, this is highly simplified, but the subjective experience of any consciousness is automatically expressed as electromagnetic energy units. These exist beneath the range of physical matter. They are, if you prefer, incipient particles that have not yet emerged into matter. These units are natural emanations from all kinds of consciousness. They are the invisible formations resulting from reaction to any kind of stimuli. They very seldom exist in isolation, but unite under certain laws. They change both their form and their pulsation. Their relative duration depends upon the original intensity behind them, that is, behind the original thought, emotion, stimuli, or reaction that brought them into being.
11:21.
Again, highly simplified here. Under certain conditions, these coagulate into matter. Those electromagnetic units of high enough intensity automatically activate the subordinate coordinate points of which I have spoken. They are, therefore, accelerated and propelled into matter far more quickly, in your terms, than units of lesser intensity. Molecules would appear as large as planets to these units. Atoms and molecules and planets and these electromagnetic energy units are simply different manifestations of the same principles that bring the units themselves into being. It is only your relative position, your focus within an apparent space and time that makes this seem so unlikely. Each thought or emotion, therefore, exists as an electromagnetic energy unit or as a combination of these under certain conditions, and often with the help of coordinate points, they emerge into the building blocks of physical matter. This emergence into matter occurs as a natural result, regardless of the nature of any given thought or emotion. Mental images accompanied by strong emotion are blueprints, therefore, upon which a corresponding physical object, or condition, or event, will, in your terms, appear. Now, end of dictation. Do you have questions?
No.
We are doing very well with our Chapter 5. My heartiest regards and a fond good evening.
Good night, Seth, and thank you very much. 11:32 p.m. Session 525, April 22nd, 1970, 9:14 p.m., Wednesday. Seth's dictation on his book tonight was preceded by 4 pages of personal material that we have deleted. Resume after break at 10:03.
The intensity of a feeling or thought or mental image is, therefore, the important element in determining its subsequent physical materialization. The intensity is the core about which the electromagnetic energy units form. In your terms, the more intense the core, the sooner the physical materialization. This would apply whether the mental image was a fearful one or a joyful one. Now there is a very important problem here. If your turn of mind is highly intense and you think in vivid mental, emotional images, these will be swiftly formed into physical events. If you are also of a highly pessimistic nature, given to thoughts and feelings of potential disaster, then these thoughts will be quite faithfully reproduced in experience. The more intense your imagination and inner experience, therefore, the more important it is that you realize the methods by which this inner experience becomes physically real. Your thoughts and emotions begin their journey into physical actualization at the moment of conception. If you happen to live in an area where the coordinate environment is strong, one of those areas I have spoken of as unusually conducive, then it will seem that you are deluged by illnesses or disasters, if these are the nature of your thoughts, because all thought is so fertile in this environment. If, on the other hand, your feelings and subjective experience are fairly well balanced, fairly optimistic and creative in a constructive manner, then it will seem to you that you have been blessed with unusual luck, for your pleasant suppositions will come to pass so quickly. Briefly, in your own country, the West Coast, portions of the East Coast, Utah, the Great Lakes, the Chicago area, the Minneapolis area, and some other southwestern areas are in those neighborhoods of excellent coordinate activity for the reasons given. Materialization will quickly appear. The potentials, therefore, for both constructive and destructive elements are high.
10:20.
Give us a moment. These coordinate points themselves activate the behavior of atoms and molecules as, say, for example, the sun aids the growth of plants. The coordinates activate the generating behavior of atoms and molecules and greatly encourage their cooperative abilities, their tendency to swarm, so to speak, into organizations and structural groupings. The coordinate points magnify or intensify the behavior, the latent spontaneity inherent within the properties of physical matter. They act as psychic generators, propelling what is not yet physical into physical form. Now you may take your break.
10:25 to 10:38.
Now, this is not to be a technical book, so this is not the time nor place to discuss thoroughly the action, behavior, or effects of these coordinate points, nor of the electromagnetic energy units, those natural emanations of consciousness of which I spoke. I want it known, however, that thoughts and emotions are formed into physical matter by very definite methods and through laws quite valid, though they may be presently unknown. In other portions of the Seth material, these processes will be made very clear for those of you who desire to pursue the question further, or those who may be interested from a scientific point of view. Here we are discussing such issues only because they touch upon the multidimensional aspect of personality. They allow you to materialize certain subjective experiences into three-dimensional reality. Before I leave the subject, however, let me remind you that these emanations in varying degrees rise from all consciousness, not simply your own. This includes cellular consciousness as well, so that an invisible network of electromagnetic units pervades your entire atmosphere. And upon this web work and from it, the particles of physical matter are then formed. Now, a whole book could easily be written upon this subject. Information regarding the locations of main and absolute coordinate points could be highly advantageous, for example. You pride yourselves on your technology and the production of durable goods, buildings and roads, yet many of these are insignificant when compared to other structures within the past. A true understanding of the way in which an idea becomes physical matter would result in a complete revamping of your so-called modern technology and in buildings, roads, and other structures that would far outlast those you now have. While the psychic reality behind physical matter is ignored, then you cannot use those methods effectively that do exist, nor can you take advantage of them. You cannot understand the psychic reality that is the true impetus for your physical existence unless you first realize your own psychic reality and independence from physical laws. My first purpose, therefore, is to make you aware of the inner identity of which you are part, and to clear away some of the intellectual and superstitious debris that prevents you from recognizing your own potentialities and freedom. Then perhaps you can begin to learn the ways in which that freedom can be used. That is the end of dictation. It may well be the end of chapter 5. You may end the session or take a break if you prefer.
We'll take the break then. 10:58 p.m. It developed that this was the end of the session. We were both tired. Jane's pace had been considerably faster than last session. Her eyes closed much of the time. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 6. The Soul and the Nature of Its Perception.
Session 526, May 4, 1970, 10 p.m., Monday. The session began late this evening because of my own distractions with painting. I worked late and needed a short rest. Jane felt well. Her pace was quite rapid, as fast as it's been, I believe, since Seth started his book. Jane's manner was easy and relaxed, her voice average, her eyes closed often.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, we will have a short session and begin to dictate the next chapter. With the little background given so far, we can at least begin to discuss the subject of this book, the eternal validity of the soul. Even when we are exploring other issues, we will be trying to illustrate the multidimensional aspect of this inner self. There are many misconceptions connected with it, and first of all, we shall try to dismiss these. First of all, a soul is not something that you have. It is what you are. I usually use the term entity in preference to the term soul, simply because those particular misconceptions are not so connected with the word entity, and its connotations are less religious in an organizational sense. The trouble is that you frequently consider the soul or entity as a finished static thing that belongs to you but is not you. The soul or entity, in other words, your most intimate, powerful inner identity, is and must be forever changing. It is not, therefore, something like a cherished heirloom. It is alive, responsive, curious. It forms the flesh and the world that you know, and it is in a state of becoming. Now, in the three-dimensional reality in which your ego has its main focus, becoming presupposes arrival, or a destination, an ending to that which has been in a state of becoming. But the soul, or entity, has its existence basically in other dimensions, and in these, fulfillment is not dependent upon arrivals at any points, spiritual or otherwise. The soul, or entity, is always in a state of flux, or learning, and of developments that have to do with subjective experience rather than with time or space. This is not nearly as mysterious as it might sound. Each of my readers plays a game in which the egotistical conscious self pretends not to know what the whole self definitely does know. Since the ego is definitely a part of the whole self, then it must necessarily be basically aware of such knowledge. In its intense focus in physical reality, however, it pretends not to know until it feels able to utilize the information in physical terms. You do have access to the inner self, therefore. You are hardly cut off from your own soul or entity. The ego prefers to consider itself the captain at the helm, so to speak, since it is the ego who most directly deals with the sometimes tumultuous seas of physical reality, and it does not want to be distracted from this task. Channels, psychological and psychic, always exist, sending communications back and forth through the various levels of the self, and the ego accepts necessary information and data from inner portions of the personality without question. Its position, in fact, depends in a large manner upon this unquestioning acceptance of inner data. The ego, in other words, the exterior self that you think of as yourself, that portion of you maintains its safety and its seeming command precisely because inner layers of your own personality constantly uphold it, keep the physical body operating, and maintain communications with the multitudinous stimuli that come both from outside conditions and inside conditions. The soul or entity is not diminished, but expanded through reincarnations, through existence and experience in probable realities, something that I will explain later.
1019.
It is only because you have a highly limited conception of your own entity that you insist upon its being almost sterile in its singularity. There are millions of cells within your body, but you call your body a unit and consider it your own. You do form it from the inside out, and yet you form it from living substance, and each smallest particle has its own living consciousness. There are clumps of matter, and in that respect there are clumps of consciousness, each individual, with their own destiny and abilities and potentials. There are no limitations to your own entity. Therefore, how can your entity or soul have boundaries? For boundaries would enclose it and deny it freedom. You may take your break.
1024. Jane resumed at the same fast pace at 1033.
Now, often it seems that the soul is thought of as a precious stone to be finally presented as a gift to God, or considered as some women used to consider their virginity, something highly prized that must be lost, the losing of it being signified as a fine gift to the receiver. In many philosophies, this sort of idea is retained, the soul being returned to a primal giver, or being dissolved in a nebulous state somewhere between being and non-being. The soul is, however, first of all, creative. It can be discussed from many viewpoints. Its characteristics can be given to some degree, and indeed, most of my readers could find out these characteristics for themselves if they were highly enough motivated, and if this was their main concern. The soul, or entity, is itself the most highly motivated, most highly energized, and most potent consciousness unit known in any universe. It is energy concentrated to a degree quite unbelievable to you. It contains potentials unlimited, but it must work out its own identity and form its own worlds. It carries within it the burden of all being. Within it are personality potentials beyond your comprehension. Remember, this is your own soul or entity I am speaking of, as well as soul or entity in general. You are one manifestation of your own soul. How many of you would want to limit your reality, your entire reality, to the experience you now know? You do this when you imagine that your present self is your entire personality, or insist that your identity be maintained unchanged through an endless eternity.
1043.
Such an eternity would be dead indeed. In many ways, the soul is an incipient God, and later in this book we will discuss the God concept. For now, however, we will simply be concerned with the entity or soul, the larger self that whispers even now in the hidden recesses of each reader's experience. I hope in this book not only to assure you of the eternal validity of your soul or entity, but to help you sense its vital reality within yourself. First of all, however, you must have some idea of your own psychological and psychic structure. When you understand to some extent who and what you are, then I can explain more clearly who and what I am. I hope to acquaint you with those deeply creative aspects of your own being, so that you can use these to extend and expand your entire experience. That is the end of dictation. Now, give me a moment. I wanted to begin this chapter. It always makes Rupert feel better. It ends the suspense as to what the next chapter will be, but give me a moment here. Now, Remember in your portrait the sense of play and a light hand. Otherwise, you lose your sparkling colors and end up with a murkiness that you do not intend. Remember that the soul is plain behind the facade that you see, that even the body is in a constant state of almost magical activity, even though, as you paint it in its chair, it is physically motionless.
Here, unexpectedly, Seth referred to a large portrait I've been working on for the last month, and the one that gave me so much trouble today. The painting is of a patient in the hospital where my father stays. The subject sits mute and quite rigid in his wheelchair. Everything went well until I ran into difficulties with the color of his clothing. I found this so irritating, finally, that I ended up doing the whole thing over. As usual, Seth's observations about painting are excellent. I've said this many times before. Nor have I ever heard Jane discuss painting in Seth's manner. The two personalities approach the subject from widely divergent viewpoints.
You want the feeling within that apparent state of motionlessness, of highly accelerated contained activity that cannot be physically expressed. That must radiate from the painting despite the obvious and illusionary appearance of your figure. You are stressing perhaps too strongly the aspects of the chair as the binding elements that hold your figure more or less stationary. He, of course, also creates the chair, as you know, and therefore the limitations. I believe there is some difficulty, or was.
There was.
With the lower right-hand corner, a matter perhaps of needing more transparent lights. Not too obviously applied, however. You are working these matters out. Do you have questions?
I guess not. I'm too bleary to think.
I will close our session. My heartiest regards and a fond good evening.
Thank you, Seth. It's been very good.
Thank you for taking dictation when you were weary.
Well, I wasn't that badly off. 10:58 p.m. Jane's pace had been good right up until the end of the session. Session 527, May 11th, 1970, 9:12 p.m., Monday.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, we will continue with the chapter we began. Many individuals imagine the soul to be an immortalized ego, forgetting that the ego, as you know it, is only a small portion of the self. So this section of the personality is simply projected onward ad infinitum, so to speak. Because the dimensions of your reality are so little understood, your concepts are bound to be limited. In considering immortality, mankind seems to hope for further egotistical development, and yet he objects to the idea that such development might involve change. He says, through his religions, that he has a soul indeed, without even asking what a soul is, and often he seems to regard it, again, as an object in his possession. Now, personality, even as you know it, constantly changes, and not always in ways that are anticipated. Most often, in fact, in unpredictable ways. You insist upon focusing your attention upon the similarities that are woven through your own behavior, and upon these, you build a theory that the self follows a pattern that you, instead, have transposed upon it. And the transposed pattern prevents you from seeing the self as it really is. Therefore, you also project this distorted viewpoint upon your conception of the reality of the soul. You think of the soul, therefore, in the light of erroneous conceptions that you hold regarding even the nature of your mortal selves.
9:25.
Even the mortal self, you see, is far more miraculous and wondrous than you perceive, and possesses far more abilities than you ascribe to it. You do not understand as yet the true nature of perception, even as far as the mortal self is concerned, and therefore you can hardly understand the perceptions of the soul. For the soul, above all, perceives and creates, Remember again that you are a soul now. The soul within you, therefore, is now perceiving. Its methods of perception are the same now as they were before your physical birth, and as they will be after your physical death. So, basically, the inner portion of you, the soul stuff, will not suddenly change its methods of perception nor its characteristics after physical death. You can find out what the soul is now, therefore. It is not something waiting for you at your death, nor is it something you must save or redeem, and it is also something that you cannot lose. The term to lose or save your soul has been grossly misinterpreted and distorted, for it is the part of you that is indeed indestructible. We will go into this particular matter in a portion of the book dealing with religion and the God concept. Your own personality, as you know it, that portion of you that you consider most precious, most uniquely you, will also never be destroyed or lost. It is a portion of the soul. It will not be gobbled by the soul, nor erased by it, nor subjugated by it. Nor, on the other hand, can it ever be separated. It is, nevertheless, only one aspect of your soul. Your individuality, in whatever way you want to think of it, continues to exist in your terms. It continues to grow and develop, but its growth and development is highly dependent upon its realization that while it is distinct and individual, it is also but one manifestation of the soul. To the extent that it realizes this, it learns to unfold in creativity and to use those abilities that lie inherent within it. Now, unfortunately, it would be much easier simply to tell you that your individuality continues to exist and let it go at that. While this would make a fairly reasonable parable, it has been told in that particular way before, and there are dangers in the very simplicity of the tale. The truth is that the personality you are now and the personality that you have been and will be, in the terms in which you understand time, all of these personalities are manifestations of the soul, of your soul.
942.
Your soul, therefore, the soul that you are, the soul that you are part of, that soul is a far more creative and miraculous phenomenon than you previously supposed. And when this is not clearly understood, and when the concept is watered down for simplicity's sake, as mentioned earlier, then the intense vitality of the soul can never be understood. Your soul, therefore, possesses the wisdom, information, and knowledge that is part of the experience of all of these other personalities. And you have within yourselves access to this information, but only if you realize the true nature of your reality. Let me emphasize again that these personalities exist independently within and are a part of the soul, and each of them are free to create and develop. There is, however, an inner communication, and the knowledge of one is available to any. Not after physical death, but now, in your present moment. Now the soul itself, as mentioned earlier, is not static. It grows and develops even through the experience of those personalities that compose it, and it is, to put it as simply as possible, more than the sum of its parts.
950.
Now, there are no closed systems in reality. In your physical system, the nature of your perceptions limits your idea of reality to some extent because you purposely decide to focus within a given locale. But basically speaking, consciousness can never be a closed system, and all barriers of such a nature are illusion. Therefore, the soul itself is not a closed system. When you consider the soul, however, you usually think of it in such a light, unchanging, a psychic or spiritual citadel. But citadels not only keep out invaders, they also prevent expansion and development. There are many matters here very difficult to express in words, for you are so afraid for your sense of identity that you resist the idea that the soul, for example, is an open spiritual system, a powerhouse of creativity that shoots out in all directions. And yet this is indeed the case. I tell you this, and at the same time remind you that your present personality is never lost. Now another word for the soul is entity. You see, it is not a simple matter of giving you a definition of a soul or entity, for even to have a glimpse in logical terms, you would have to understand it in spiritual, psychic, and electromagnetic terms, and understand the basic nature of consciousness and action as well. But you can intuitively discover the nature of the soul or entity, and in many ways, intuitive knowledge is superior to any other kind. One prerequisite for such an intuitive understanding of the soul is the desire to achieve it. If the desire is strong enough, then you will be automatically led to experiences that will result in vivid, unmistakable subjective knowledge. There are methods that will enable you to do this, and I will give you some toward the end of this book.
10.02.
For now, here is one quite effective but simple exercise. Close your eyes after having read this chapter to this point, and try to sense within yourself the source of power from which your own breathing and life forces come. Some of you will do this successfully at your first try. Others may take longer. When you feel within yourself this source, then try to sense this power flow outward through your entire physical being, through the fingertips and toes, through the pores of your body, all directions, with yourself as center. Imagine the rays undiminished, reaching then through the foliage and clouds above, through the center of the earth below, extending even to the farthest reaches of the universe. Now, I do not mean this to be merely a symbolic exercise, for though it may begin with imagination, it is based upon fact, and emanations from your consciousness and the creativity of your soul do indeed reach outward in that manner. The exercise will give you some idea of the true nature, creativity, and vitality of the soul from which you can draw your own energy and of which you are an individual and unique portion. You may take your break.
Thank you. 10:10. Jane had been in a deep trance. Her pace had been fast with few pauses. Seth, she said, could have cheerfully continued unabated. He called a break only because I deliberately let my weary right hand flop down on the couch. Jane felt well. She had no sense of an hour's having passed. As is often the case, Jane said she had no memory of the first portion of the chapter given on May 4th. Resume in the same fast manner at 10:27.
Now, this discussion is not meant to be an esoteric presentation with little practical meaning in your daily lives. The fact is that while you hold limited concepts of your own reality, then you cannot practically take advantage of many abilities that are your own. And while you have a limited concept of the soul, then to some extent you cut yourself off from the source of your own being and creativity. Now, these abilities operate whether you know it or not, but often they operate in spite of you rather than with your conscious cooperation. And often when you do find yourself using them, you become frightened, disoriented, or confused. No matter what you have been taught, you must understand, for example, that basically speaking, perceptions are not physical in the way the term is usually used. If you catch yourself perceiving information through other than your physical senses, then you must accept the fact that this is the way perception works. What often happens is that your conception of reality is so limited that you take fright whenever you perceive any experience that does not fit into your conception. Now, I am not speaking merely of abilities loosely called extrasensory perception. These experiences seem extraordinary to you only because you have for so long denied the existence of any perception that did not come through the physical senses. So-called extrasensory perception gives you but a crude and distorted idea of the basic ways in which the inner self receives information. But the concepts built around extrasensory perception are at least nearer the truth, and as such represent an improvement over the idea that all perception is basically physical. Now, it is nearly impossible to separate a discussion of the nature of the soul from a discussion of the nature of perception. Very briefly, let us review a few points. You form physical matter and the physical world that you know. The physical senses actually can be said to create the physical world in that they force you to perceive an available field of energy in physical terms, and impose a highly specialized pattern upon this field of reality. Using the physical senses, you can perceive reality in no other way.
1044.
This physical perception in no way alters the native, basic, unfettered perception that is characteristic of the inner self, the inner self being the portion of the soul that is within you. The inner self knows its relationship with the soul. It is a portion of the self that acts, you might say, as a messenger between the soul and the present personality. You must also realize that while I use terms like soul or entity, inner self, and present personality, I do so only for the sake of convenience, for one is a part of the other. There is no point where one begins and another ends. You can see this easily for yourself if you consider the way in which psychologists use the terms ego, subconscious, and even unconscious. What seems subconscious in one instant may be conscious the next. An unconscious motive may also be conscious at one point. Even in these terms, your experience should tell you that the words themselves make divisions that do not exist in your own experience. You seem to perceive exclusively through your physical senses, and yet you have only to extend your egotistical idea of reality, and you will find even your egotistical self accepting quite readily the existence of non-physical information.
1053.
As it does, so its own ideas of its own nature will automatically change and expand, for you will have removed limitations to its growth. Now, any act of perception changes the perceiver, and so the soul, considered as a perceiver, must also change. There are no real divisions between the perceiver and the thing seemingly perceived. In many ways, the thing perceived is an extension of the perceiver. This may seem strange, but all acts are mental, or if you prefer, psychic acts. This is an extremely simple explanation, but the thought creates the reality. Then the creator of the thought perceives the object, and he does not understand the connection between him and this seemingly separate thing. This characteristic of materializing thoughts and emotions into physical realities is an attribute of the soul. Now, in your reality, these thoughts are made physical. In other realities, they may be constructed in an entirely different fashion. So your soul, that which you are, constructs your physical daily reality for you from the nature of your thoughts and expectations. You can readily see, therefore, how important your subjective feelings really are. This knowledge that your universe is idea construction can immediately give you clues that enable you to change your environment and circumstances beneficially. When you do not understand the nature of the soul and do not realize that your thoughts and feelings form physical reality, then you feel powerless to change it. In later chapters of this book, I hope to give you some practical information that will enable you to alter practically the very nature and structure of daily life.
Jane, as Seth, leaned forward, smiling.
Do you grow weary?
I could use a break, a short one. Still in trance and quite amused, Jane continued to stare at me. Her eyes were very dark. I'm okay, I said. Do you want to continue? I'm all right.
I would not have it on my conscience. Now what we need is an extra set of fingers for you. By all means, take your break. I do not mean to keep you over long.
It's all right.
I could dictate all night one night, and then you could take 3 sessions off.
I believe you could. 11:09. Again, Jane's trance had been deep, and again I had writer's cramp. I had no doubts that Seth could speak all night. The only limitations here were our own. Jane felt a very strong energy. This break marked the end of dictation on his book for the evening, Seth announced when he returned at 11:28. He then delivered a page or so of personal material for Jane and me, and ended the session in a jovial mood at 11:35 p.m. Session 528, May 13, 1970, 9:03 p.m., Wednesday.
Now, good evening.
Good evening, Seth. Smile.
It is the writer's hour, and we will resume dictation. The soul perceives all experience directly. Most experiences of which you are aware come packaged in physical wrapping, and you take the wrapping for the experience itself and do not think of looking inside. The world that you know is one of the infinite materializations taken by consciousness, and as such, it is valid. The soul, however, does not need to follow the laws and principles that are a part of the physical reality, and it does not depend upon physical perception. The soul's perceptions are of acts and events that are mental, that lie, so to speak, beneath physical events as you know them. The soul's perceptions are not dependent upon time, because time is a physical camouflage and does not apply to non-physical reality. Now, it is difficult to explain to you how direct experience actually works, for it exists, a total field of perception, innocent of the physical clues, such as color, size, weight, and sense with which your physical perceptions are clothed.
9:19.
Words are used to tell of an experience, but they obviously are not the experience that they attempt to describe. Your physical subjective experience is so involved with word thinking, however, that it is almost impossible for you to conceive of an experience that is not thought word oriented. Now, each event of which you are aware is already a translation of an inner event, a psychic or mental event that is perceived by the soul directly, but translated by the physically oriented portions of the self into physical sense terms. It goes without saying, then, that the soul does not require a physical body for purposes of perception, that perception is not dependent upon physical senses, that experience continues whether or not you are in this life or another, and also that the soul's basic methods of perception are also operating within you now, even as you read this book. It also follows that your experience within the physical system is dependent upon a physical form and physical senses, again, because these interpret reality and translate it into physical data. It also follows that some hints of the soul's direct experience can be gained by momentarily switching the physical senses off, by refusing to use them as perceptors, and falling back upon other methods. Now, you do this to some extent in the dream state, but even then, in many dreams, you still tend to translate experience into hallucinatory physical terms. Most of the dreams that you recall are of this nature. At certain depths of sleep, however, the soul's perception operates relatively unhampered. You drink, so to speak, from the pure well of perception. You communicate with the depths of your own being and the source of your creativity. These experiences, not being translated physically, do not remain in the morning. You do not remember them as dreams. Dreams, however, may later the same evening be formed from the information gained during what I will call the depth experience. These will not be exact or near translations of the experience, but rather of the nature of dream parables, an entirely different thing, you see.
9:35.
Now, this particular level of consciousness, occurring in the sleep state, has not been pinpointed by your scientists. During it, energy is generated that makes the dream state itself possible. It is true that dreams allow the physically oriented self to digest current experience, but it is also true that the experience is then returned to its initial components. It breaks apart, so to speak. Portions of it are retained as past physical sense data, but the whole experience returns to its initial direct state. It exists then eternally, separated from the physical clothing that you need in order to understand it. Physical existence is one way in which the soul chooses to experience its own actuality. The soul, in other words, has created a world for you to inhabit, to change, a complete sphere of activity in which new developments and, indeed, new forms of consciousness can emerge. In a manner of speaking, you continually create your soul as it continually creates you. You may take your break.
9:43. At times, Jane's delivery had approached the speed of the last session. Resume more slowly at 10:05.
Now, the soul is never diminished, nor basically are any portions of the self. The soul can be considered as an electromagnetic energy field of which you are part. It is a field of concentrated action when you consider it in this light, a powerhouse of probabilities or probable actions seeking to be expressed, a grouping of non-physical consciousnesses that nevertheless knows itself as an identity. Look at it this way. The young woman through whom I speak once stated in a poem, and I quote, "These atoms speak and call themselves my name." Now, your physical body is a field of energy with a certain form, however, and when someone asks you your name, your lips speak it. And yet the name does not belong to the atoms and molecules in the lips that utter the syllables. The name has meaning only to you. Within your body, you cannot put your finger upon your own identity. If you could travel within your body, you could not find where your identity resides. Yet you say, "This is my body," and "This is my name."
10:14.
If you cannot be found, even by yourself, within your body, then where is this identity of yours that claims to hold the cells and organs as its own? Your identity obviously has some connection with your body, since you have no trouble distinguishing your body from someone else's, and you certainly have no trouble distinguishing between your body and the chair, say, upon which you may sit. In a larger manner, the identity of the soul can be seen from the same viewpoint. It knows who it is, and is far more certain of its identity, indeed, than your physical self is of its identity. And yet, now, where in this electromagnetic energy field can the identity of the soul as such be found? It regenerates all other portions of itself, and it gives you the identity that is your own. And when it should be asked, "Who are you?" it would simply answer, "I am I," and be answering for you also.
Pause at 10:20.
Now, in terms of psychology, as you understand it, the soul could be considered as a prime identity that is in itself a gestalt of many other individual consciousnesses, an unlimited self that is yet able to express itself in many ways and forms, and yet maintain its own identity, its own I am-ness, even while it is aware that its I am-ness may be part of another I am-ness. Now, I am sure it may seem inconceivable to you, but the fact is that this I am-ness is retained even though it may, figuratively speaking, now merge with and travel through other such energy fields. There is, in other words, a give and take between souls or entities and no end of possibilities, both of development and expansion. Again, the soul is not a closed system. It is only because your present existence is so highly focused in one narrow area that you put such stern limits upon your definitions and the self, and then project these upon your concepts of the soul. You worry for your physical identity and limit the extent of your perceptions for fear you cannot handle more and retain your selfhood. The soul is not frightened for its identity. It is sure of itself. It ever seeks. It is not afraid of being overwhelmed by experience or perception. If you had a more thorough understanding of the nature of identity, you would not, for example, fear telepathy. For behind this concern is the worry that your identity will be swept away by the suggestions or thoughts of others. No psychological system is closed. No consciousness is closed, regardless of any appearances to the contrary within your own system. The soul is a traveler, as has been said so often. But it is also the creator of all experience and of all destinations in your terms. It creates worlds as it goes, so to speak. Now, this is the true nature of the psychological being of which you are part. As mentioned earlier, later in the book, I will give you some practical suggestions that will allow you to recognize some of your own deeper abilities and utilize them for your own development, pleasure, and education. Consciousness is not basically built upon those precepts of good and evil that so presently concern you. By inference, neither is a soul. This does not mean that in your system and in some others, these problems do not exist and that good is not preferable to the evil. It simply means that the soul knows that good and evil are but different manifestations of a far greater reality. Now you may take your break.
10:37 to 10:44.
Now, I want to emphasize again that while all this sounds difficult in the telling, it becomes much more clear intuitively when you learn to experience what you are. For if you cannot travel inside your physical body to find your identity, you can travel through your psychological self. There are far more wonders to perceive through this inward exploration than you can possibly believe until you begin such a journey for yourself. You are a soul. You are a particular manifestation of a soul, and it is sheer nonsense to think that you must remain ignorant of the nature of your own being. You may not be able to put your knowledge clearly into words, but this will in no way negate the value or the validity of the experience that will be yours once you begin to look inward. Now, you may call this a spiritual or psychological or psychic exploration as you prefer. You will not be trying to find your soul. In that respect, there is nothing to find. It is not lost, and you are not lost. The words you use may make no difference, but your intent does indeed. End of dictation. And now give us a moment, if you please.
Pause at 10:51. As in the last session, Seth closed the evening's work by delivering a page of personal material for Jane and me. End at 11:01 p.m. Jane hasn't been reading Seth's book lately. After listening to my description of this session, however, she asked me to give her a copy of a couple of pages after I type them. She wants to read them to her ESP class. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 7. The Potentials of the Soul.
Session 530, May 20th, 1970, 9:19 p.m., Wednesday.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, we will resume dictation, and we are beginning Chapter 8.
Note, this was apparently a slip of the tongue.
It seems to you that you have only one form, the physical one that you perceive, and no other. It also seems that your form can only be in one place at one time. You have indeed other forms that you do not perceive, and you can also create various kinds of forms for various purposes, although you do not perceive these physically either. Your main sense of identity is involved with your physical body, so that it is, for example, extremely difficult for you to imagine yourself without it, or outside it, or in any way disconnected from it. Form is the result of concentrated energy, the pattern for it caused by vividly directed emotional or psychic idea images. The intensity is all important. If you have, for example, a highly vivid desire to be somewhere else, then without realizing it consciously, a pseudo-physical form identical with your own may appear in that very spot. The desire will carry the imprint of your personality and image, even though you remain unaware of the image or its appearance in the other location. Though this thought image usually is not seen by others, it is quite possible that in the future scientific instruments may perceive it. As it is, such an image may be perceived by those who have developed use of the inner senses. Any intense mental act, thought, or emotion will not only be constructed in some physical or pseudo-physical manner, but will also bear to some extent the imprint of the personality who originally conceived it.
9:30.
There are many such incipient or latent forms. To help you imagine what I am speaking of, you might think of them as ghost images or shadow images, though this is only for the sake of analogy. Forms, for example, just beneath, that have not emerged completely into physical reality as you know it, but are nevertheless vivid enough to be constructed. You would think them quite real, indeed, if you could see them. Each individual actually sends such replica images of himself out frequently, though the degree of the materialization may differ, some forms, for example, being more or less shadowy than others. However, these forms are not mere projections, flat images. They have a definite effect upon the atmosphere. They make room for themselves in ways that are rather difficult to explain, although they may coexist at times with physical objects or shapes, or may even be superimposed upon these. In this case, there is a definite interaction, an interchange that is, again, beneath physical perception. You may suddenly strongly wish that you were standing by a beloved but distant familiar seashore, for example. This intense desire would then act something like a core of energy projected outward from your own mind, given a form, your form. The place that you had envisioned would then attract the form, and it would instantaneously stand there. This happens with great frequency. It would not be seen under usual circumstances. On the other hand, if the desire were still more intense, the energy core would be greater, and a portion of your own flow of consciousness would be imparted to the form, so that, for a moment, you in your room might suddenly smell the salt air, or in some other way perceive the environment in which this pseudo-image stands.
9:44.
The extent of perception will vary here to a great degree. To begin with, your physical form is the result of great emotional focus. The fantastic energy of your psyche not only created your physical body, but maintains it. It is not one continuous thing, although to you it seems permanent enough while it lasts. It is, nevertheless, in a constant state of pulsation, and because of the nature of energy and its construction, The body is actually blinking off and on. Now, this is difficult to explain, and for our present purposes, it is not entirely necessary that you understand the reasons for this pulsing. But even physically, you are not here as often as you are. Your emotional intensity and focus